model was hinged both at the front and at the rear. It was hinged at the front so the back of the deck lid could be raised in the normal manner in order to get at luggage. It was also hinged at the back, down low, just above the rear bumper, so that its front could rise and swallow the roof as the roof slid back into that area. The way to do this had come to me from my work on aircraft. Some doors in aircraft, such as armored doors under bombardiers, could be released by pulling a handle that released four pins at each corner of the door. And I had observed that some people would walk under a particular airplane, wonder what that little handle was up above and pull it, and they would be knocked unconscious by the door falling down.
The handle was exterior?
Well, the handle was recessed into a little pocket. But if half of the pins, that is the pins on one side released, the thing would come down in a hinged manner working on the other pins. And so what we did was quite simple. When you wanted to open the trunk lid to get in there, you turn the trunk lid handle, and two pins withdrew, much the way the pins operate on an inexpensive overhead garage door. Mm-hmm. Same scheme. And you could raise it. But if the roof was going to push up the front of the deck lid, those pins at the rear remaining in place would form hinge pins. Work something like that. But it shows how some of these experiences carry over into a different field. Well, we made the 8 scale model. It worked strictly by hand or by finger.
Did you do, you mentioned it.
We found that visitors to the studio became quite intrigued by this. Now, we have an old problem growing here. We had engineers in charge of styling. Really running styling, we had a stylist, Gene Bordenay. But he couldn't get this idea shown to people above him. He had a barrier. He thought that was a good idea, evidently, because one day he called me up and warned me he might want to borrow that model. And at lunchtime, he came hustling back to the studio, took the model, and a little book I had made by hand that explained what it was all about. And he hustled it up to the other end of Mahogany Row and showed it to
You're still in the engineering laboratory.
We're still back in, I forgot to mention that, we're in the building next to the museum.
Mm-hmm. Now called the Triple E building.
Called the Triple E. And it was the older Henry Ford's old dancing academy, I believe.
Portion, yeah.
Gene hustled it up to the other end of the building, went over the heads of a few people by doing so, and showed it to McPherson.
Who was
the vice president of engineering at the time.
Harold McPherson.
Yeah, that's right.
Over from GM.
Yeah, well, it was Harold Ljunggren who was his predecessor.
Earl McPherson.
Yeah. Now, how do you spell that? M-A-C capital P-H-E-R-S-O-N.
Right.
I think Earl was spelled with an E on the end, but I'm not sure. At any rate,
he was vice president of engineering.
He was vice president of engineering, and us, he was the big man. Gene told me later that McPherson looked at it and said, "Who did that?" And Gene told him something, and McPherson said, "I didn't know a stylist could ever come up with an idea like that." And he got up and came all the way down to our end of the building and started playing with the model. I think the model was left back. Gene just took the book up.
Okay.
Correction there.
Yeah.
And McPherson was very pleased with it.
And intrigued, obviously.
He was intrigued. And he gave us the go-ahead to take some money and spend on making a bigger electric model. Because up to that time, the little model was just made in spare time when we could find time to work on it. And that's why this project took so long at this stage. At any rate, we then started the 3/8 electric model that we called the CERTUS.
Did he give you a sort of, did McPherson give you a sort of an unofficial go-ahead?
He gave us a go-ahead, mm-hmm. and he told us to, to point some money opposite it, to, spend some money on it. And that meant that we could, in addition, have work done in the shops to help us.
So now, were you authorized to get a full-size model, or is this?
No, we were authorized to go to 3/8. This 3/8. Is what I was saying I wanted to do.
And you just mentioned the code name, which was.
Well, I in my number book. I also had quite a few pages reserved for names. I encouraged the men in the studio, whenever they thought of a name that might be useful for a car, to write it in. They wrote names that named after birds or rockets or whatever. The identification, the reason for using a name was simply that a number was boring and not rememberable. And these names, while you've gone through that before, I'm sure, these names wouldn't necessarily be used on an actual car later on. They were just our names.
And the name was?
CERTUS.
And how do you spell that?
S-Y-R-T-I-S.
That
was one of my stellar names that I had written up. It was some place that gotten that name on the surface of the moon, which in those days was an unknown, mysterious thing. And I thought, well, now there's a mysterious name, and it has to do with stellar and up in the sky where the rockets go. I found out years later that's the name of a place over in the north coast of Africa. It's either a Latin or a Greek name originating there many, many years ago.
It had the right ring to it.
Yeah, it seemed right. And I originated this styling design for the thing. I was trying to take a rock, what we thought was a rocket shape with fins, and this particular one has great big chrome stacks with red interiors coming out from underneath it. I wanted to attract attention. I wanted people to be stunned when they saw this.
The stack, did you say?
Oh, these are exhaust stacks underneath here.
Okay. The exhaust ports were known as stacks.
Well, if they were in the stacks, that's right. If they were in the form of pipes. Yeah, of course, in designing automobiles long ago, a lot of names are adapted from shipboard.
Right.
The same kind of people worked on them and did the drafting and layout.
For an oral audience, can you describe this particular vehicle?
Well, I'll try to. The front fender starts out as a rather sharp point viewed from the side, and proceeds all the way back to the back end of the car. But as the top of it goes back, it slopes downhill, especially past the driver's elbow, giving a cockpit feel. And then the side in a form of a long fin rises up about where the outer edge of the front seat back would be. And that proceeds on back to the tail end and forms the tail light. Underneath, a symmetrically opposite upside down shape comes down from this fender shape and goes on past the back wheel to the back bumper. In front of where that rear fin comes down, we have these four big exhaust stacks, which probably wouldn't be real stacks, but since the model was made out of clay and then out of plaster, it didn't matter. Recall it was 3/8 scale. We had Howard Fifield. Don't know if it's important. IELD, who later was in charge of the metal shops and styling, beat out a roof, which suited the size of the 3/8 model out of metal, and he also formed a rear deck for us, which had to be hollow out of metal. The roof, the rear corners of the roof traveled aft on small casters in a track, which ran aft over the rear wheel housing and then dipped down in an S-curve and terminated in front of the back bumper. This carried the rear end of the roof down. An arm where the B-pillar was rotated and drove the roof back that way. The front corners of the deck lid rode in casters on the drip rail of the roof. So as the roof went back, it raised the rear of the deck lid up. The deck lid in this case appeared to swallow it, but actually was raised up by the roof. And when the roof went down into its final retracted position, the deck lid settled on top of it. And we had other ways of locking it. Before this happened, or midway as it happened, the backlight, which some people call the back window, swung down on pivots behind the rear seat, behind the back of the rear seat. On those same pivots, that backlight could be swung forward to form a windshield in front of the back seat passengers. The windshield on this model came up higher than the normal windshield because it also curved back, which, as I had said before, helped to shorten the roof.
This was electrically controlled, did you say?
And we operated this with an electric motor from a battery.
Mm-hmm.
We simply took a motor, an electric motor that would operate a window on a full-size car. And
this was not interior, this was exterior.
Well,
it wasn't within the 3/8 model.
It was inside the 3/8 model.
Mm-hmm. And quite a small motor.
And it, they are little motors, but 3/8 model is pretty big.
Okay.
And we had this go back. Now, we had a little bit of a difficulty here. I just wanted to get a little electric motor and gear it and run it. Electrical engineering got into this. I don't know whether McPherson or somebody told them to go down and check what those stylists are doing. And they decided that we might electrocute young Mr. Henry Ford or somebody else. I had designed a little remote control. I had a nice looking cable coming out from under this model, and designed a little switch mechanism which was in a case that would look like a kind of a streamlined electric shaver, but it had a rocker switch on it. This would have direct house current, the way I was doing it.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't want any more than 6 volts coming up there, play it safe. So they said, let us do this part. They supplied the motor from a window. We put it on a 3/8 model table that I had made for display purposes. I had a bunch of them made before that. We hung curtains around the side of it, and we suspended an automobile battery underneath and ran a cable up through the table into the bottom of this model. But they stepped the battery current down to just a couple of volts with a, you don't call it a transformer, I forget what you do call it. At any rate, they staged the electricity down. In other words, when Mr. Ford or somebody else pressed the switch, they were turning a very low voltage circuit on, which flipped its own switch underneath the car, which turned the heavier current on. And therein lies a tale. We got the model ready, and it did excite people. We had quite a number of executives, top executives of the company, telling each other about it and coming in and playing with it. And finally, the proposal was made that it be considered by the I'm trying to think of the name of the committee. The committee that votes...
Policy committee.
Policy committee, the finance committee, and so forth. At this time, The...
This is before you had a design committee.
Right. For some time, one of our projects had been designing Continental proposals. We wanted to bring the Continental back.
The early 50s.
What's that?
The early 50s.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We were... I spent a lot of time making drawings and renderings of what I thought were nice ideas for Continentals. Nobody could get the company to do anything. It seemed like everybody wanted to bring Continental out again.
You
after
didn't
war.
Want to continue the post-war facelifts. You wanted to continue to the original, of the original.
No, we just wanted to come out with new cars that would have the same feel for their time era as the original Continental had, but be modern.
Right.
Pardon. And we spent a lot of time on this. We never could bring it to fruition, and now it looked as if it was going to happen. William Clay Ford was going to be in charge of this new division. They were going to build him his own studios and his own little engineering place over next to I-94. And
in Allen Park.
Yeah, in Allen Park. That's now a sort of a, what do they call that?
Pilot plant.
Pilot plant. It's a pilot plant. And it's been enlarged, of course. But it was decided that this idea would go for the new Continental. It would be a real, real good thing. And I was to demonstrate it in front of these various committees. So we got the thing all shined up, made sure it was working, and I had to show it to two committees in the morning, and then after lunch show it to the third more important committee for the final vote, I guess, for the financing. And so I demonstrated it, and it came off real well. Really, all I had to do was say a few words and press the button, and this thing had a very sinuous motion. People sort of fell for it right away when they saw this thing.
There's no creaking and clanking.
Yeah, it's like a swan's neck
mm-hmm.
moving.
Right.
It was, you know, a real smooth, pleasing motion, simple as it is.
All in one motion, too.
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. You know, it was enthusiastically taken. In fact, I got hand clapping in a meeting like that. Mm-hmm. Unusual. The car was kind of glittery. The top had metallic flakes in it. It was dark, and the bottom was... very reflective. It had a lot of pearlescence worked into it, especially. The second meeting came up. It might have been a third meeting. There were either three or four meetings that day. And these were important people, and it was important. I got up there, and I gave my spiel, pressed the button, and nothing happened. You know, I could have sunk through the floor. I probably started to. But it simply wouldn't work, and the only thing I could think to say was, well, it worked this morning, you know, and the meeting broke up, and a lot of the people who were the executives watching this came over and sympathized with me. They knew it worked, you know, and patted me on the back and said, there, Gil. Well, I went off to a late lunch in the little dining room and back there, and I got out a piece of paper. And I wrote down what I was going to say. I'd never done that before, but I decided nothing's going to fluster me. I got the electrical engineers up there to work on their part of it. And they came back and said, it works fine, Gil. And I, oh, wow, that's great. What happened? Well, where that cable coming up out of the floor of the table went up into the model, it was plugged in because they had to thread it through a hole in the table.
Mm-hmm.
And the plug came loose and fell down.
You.
And then I remembered, and if you ever talk to Johnny Reinhart, you can remind him of this. John was supposed to be the chief stylist for this new car, the Continental. And he had attended these meetings, and he had come by, and he had mentioned to me, something's sticking out here, Gil, and he gave it a yank.
Oh.
Not realizing what he was doing to me. He sort of just pushed it on under the model, and that disengaged him. But he came around later and apologized. He realized that he had done it. But
in the meantime, these dignitaries had dispersed.
Well, the big bunch, and a lot of these people in the and the big committee were also members of the other committees. You know how they interlace these people. They came back.
You had all broken for lunch.
Yeah, they broke for lunch, came back. I took off, came back, and I propped my little prepared speech up on one side of the model and said my thing and pushed the button, and it worked, and great. I think they voted, I don't know, some $2.5 million or something like that for the project, for the Continental.
What year was this now?
Oh, I got to find out.
Just give us a ballpark.
Oh, I don't, the trouble is I don't remember. It was done over the dimensions of the 52 Ford.
Okay.
And the Certus was shown publicly in March 1953. Excuse me, I got to take a drink. This is doesn't sound at first as if it's relevant to the subject, but about this time we came out with a book called Ford at 50, and on page 68 and page 69 there are photographs of me demonstrating the original 1/8 scale model and the booklet I talked about to executives of the company, including Henry Grebe, who at that time was head of body engineering. These were publicity pictures, but unfortunately they were published a little bit ahead of time. If someone realized, looking at that book, what they were, they might start on their own project in another company.
It's 1953, I think it was published.
Yeah. So, and then a man in the studio who had started as a draftsman but also worked as a designer, Jim Huggins, H-U-G-G-I-N-S, had worked in this project, but then left to go with Chrysler. And so we were afraid the cat was out of the bag, that Huggins had taken it over to Chrysler. I don't know whether he ever did or not, really, but we had this fear. And also the fact that this book had been published with some earlier pictures of the model. So we decided to show pictures of the Certus right away, publicly, so Ford would be credited with it. And so we announced it at that time. Later on, we at SAE meetings, we would get some banter from the Chrysler engineering people about their retractable hardtop model that they were working on. So we had good reason to think that either Huggins or somebody else had taken the tail over there.
Certus is spelled
S-Y-R-T-I-S.
Right.
Now, if you recall, what was the name of the ocean liner that was sunk? The Andrea Doria.
Right.
The Andrea Doria was carrying a full-size car that had been made for Chrysler over in Italy.
Mm-hmm.
And
was it the Norseman?
I don't recall what the name was now, but it was reputed at that time to be their answer to the secret hardtop convertible. And I've often been curious as to what it was, because it's at the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean now.
Did you ever ask Don Kopka?
No, I never did.
I
should.
Might have known.
I should do that. Yeah. But that's why I was looking for that picture.
It was a Ghia.
It was a Ghia. It was a Ghia thing, but it was supposed to have their version of retractable top on there.
Now,
and I suspect it was pretty much like one that Huggins started working on before he left Ford. Because I told him, Jim, work on a competitor to what we've come up with here, just so we can see what another company might produce and get patents on it ourselves. You know, what's the next best thing? Or maybe it's a better way.
It's been reputed that there was also a secret Ford model on the Andrea Doria. Do you recall anything about
no,
that?
No, I didn't know that.
Okay.
First I've heard of it.
Right.
There were various 3/8 models of other schemes for retractable hardtops that came out within the next year and a half. Obviously people trying to sell the idea. In fact, my superior at that time instructed me to store
his name?
Charlie Waterhouse.
Right, okay.
Have you got him? W-A-T-E-R-H-O-U-S-E. And I'm sure he had instructions from someone above him, told me to store a 3/8 working model of another retractable that somebody else had made. I think a company that produced and had patents for cloth top convertibles. I think they.
How did you obtain this 3/8 model?
I didn't obtain it. It was forced onto me. I had to store that.
Oh, he gave it to you.
He had it brought in, told me not to dare touch it, leave it alone, provide a cover for it, don't let anybody touch it. And it stood, oh, must have been for a year and a half or so, it stood around.
A competitive model by someone outside of the Ford studio?
That's right, yeah, that's right. Well, somebody outside of Ford Motor Company.
You never found out who that was?
No, but I suspected it came from a company that did convertible tops and convertible top mechanism. I'm talking about soft tops.
Yes, right.
And they had patents on them and sold them to the parts and made the parts for various automotive companies.
This was
and I think they were trying. I think they were they probably at that time thought the conventional, that is ragtop convertible, might be on its way out, and they better get into this new way of going.
Even though it was a cloth top, it recessed into the rear deck.
It was not a cloth top, it was a hard top.
Oh, it was a hard top.
Recessed.
Okay. Right. And, was it the same principle that you come up with?
No, I had three principles that I applied. I made patent drawings for. I had alternate ways of doing it, just to cover.
Yeah.
And it was one of those. And I tried to tell people that we already had the patent applications in, but the thing stayed around here and around there, and I rather resented being called on the carpet, because at lunchtime or in the evening, some people would come in and fool around with this thing and perhaps damage it. Then I would have to fix it and stand the blame for. But this is part of the design game.
Yeah.
Eventually, it disappeared, and my Certus model eventually was some years later. I guess was destroyed. It was deliberately was done away with.
Photos of it still exist in the photographic department. Yes.
But I'd give anything to get a hold of that little 8-scale model. I bet somebody has that someplace
really?
Today.
You think so?
Yeah, because it...
What do you think might have it? Let's make some inquiries.
Oh, I wouldn't have the slightest idea. But it made an interesting toy. Maybe it'll surface someday. Mm-hmm. Well, the... I'll try to terminate this a little quicker. The scheme was bought, and as you probably know, although they thought it would go best on an expensive car like the new Continental.
There was a very real effort to adapt it to the Mark II, the subsequent Mark II.
Oh yeah, they built models on it. Mm-hmm. That is full-size cars, handmade, that work. But
John Reinhardt was involved in this?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Eventually that new division had to turn around and sell it to the Ford division, who could make more money off of it and sell it cheaper for
you. How far did the idea for the Continental retractable hardtop go? It got as far as what stage?
Oh, it got as far as full-size handmade cars.
Full-size drivable prototypes?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, whether they were, whether they had an engine in them, I don't know, but I'm sure it'll say so in this book.
Okay. But in any event, to you, they utilized your concept completely. There was no.
No, that's part of the story. Okay, now the Certus sold the idea, and it was turned over to, I'll call them production engineers, who were going to make a car that was producible, or a version. I felt I had done my job. I'd originated an idea, got somebody going on it. I wanted to go on to other things. There was talk of, why don't you come to work for this division and work on it, but I didn't. Now, a little bit of, I'm trying not to make it sound like snideness comes in here. I went to meetings as they slowly adapted this thing, in case I could say something to help. Within a period of 3 or 4 months, I gradually dropped out of these meetings. I figured I'm no longer needed. It was going in a different way. I had visualized this as being a fairly simple thing. But the the people that took it over, how can I put that? They rejected the original way it was done. They did it differently. I go for simplicity in ideas. I think they ended up with 9 little electric motors. They had parts that folded over. They had a retractable package shelf in back of the back seat. I visualized the occupant of the car could simply put stuff down through this hole.
What was to be your motive power? The chief source of your the motive power on the roof.
Well, it was nothing different. There's nothing different about it. It would be an electric motor, but the point is that only need to be one or possibly one on each side. It was quite a simple thing. I don't think we have to get into detail here, except to say that the scheme that ended up on the road was far more complicated, and it could not contain as much in the trunk area. For example, the Certus model had scale models of the extra size golf bag that we heard Henry Ford used, and plus luggage. The car that ended up on the road was very restrictive about what it could hold.
You're talking about trunk space.
Trunk space, right. I was experiencing quite a bit of disappointment the way this project was going. And
had it taken out of your hands?
Oh, it was completely out of my hands. And
by whom?
Well, Harley Kopp took it over. I think he was the chief engineer there.
For the New Continental.
For the New Continental.
Right.
The story is pretty well told in the
COPP.
Yeah, COPP. The story is pretty well told in the Ford retractable book by Jerry H. Magayn. Magayne. And I don't think I should take the time here to repeat it.
But give us the essence.
Well, I was disappointed in how it was going. And so I didn't have to take any more part in it, and I didn't. I took everything I'd done on the project, including drawings, bundled them up into a large paper shopping bag, and put them in a file drawer.
You didn't make them available to the Kopp Reinhardt team?
Oh, anything I did was already had been available to them. They already had copies,
okay.
You know, they had information from me in meetings, but I didn't feel that I wanted to be identified with the project, to tell the truth. And so I put everything I'd done away on it, and it wasn't until I retired many years later that I came across the bundle, you know, when you go through your personal files. And by this time, they were old hat stuff, of course. I took that bundle home, and I kept it in a box in a closet. And when Magayn called me a couple of years ago, I opened up the box, and by this time, my bundle was, 33 years old or something like that, and went through it for him, and in fact, sent him copies of things and made it available to him. But a lot of people who I knew later on never knew I had anything to do with that project. It was just one of those cases of not wanting to, you know, if I said, oh, yeah, I was involved in that, people would say to me, well, what did you do it this way for? And I didn't want to say because I didn't do it in a particular way.
But, in other words, your single engine concept for the motive power of the disappearing top metamorphosed into six or
something
eight,
too complicated.
Eight smaller engines.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which would work in sequence.
Yeah. I had this feeling about ideas when you come up with when you conceive of an idea and you start working on it. On some ideas, things just seem to start dropping into place just right. And you get the feeling that you're onto something good. And I felt that way about that project. I was quite disappointed to have it go otherwise, but the fact that I dropped out of it didn't hold up anything anyway.
Of course, it did not materialize on the on the Mark II.
No.
But did come out in the Ford line a couple of years later.
That's right.
1957?
Yeah, 57, 58.
How did that come about? Were you involved in that?
No, I was not involved in it. It's simply that the Continental Division couldn't afford to produce the car, whereas the Ford Division could.
Much less sheet metal, then.
Well, no, I think it's just... I think it was a case of having to make more of them to get the money out of the project.
You know, item, yes.
Yeah, amortize
the cost,
tooling, and so forth.
Who took? Just to jump ahead a bit, who pushed that through in the Ford division?
I don't remember. I don't remember. It may be in this book.
You knew, of course, it was going on after the Continental Division dropped it.
Oh yes, yeah, I knew that. But
they knew that you were the originator of the concept.
Yeah, but by this time, I had no interest in it whatsoever.
Oh,
I mean, I actually was not involved.
Oh, I see.
And hadn't been for a few years.
But of course, you retained your interest in spite of your.
Yes,
yourself.
I never bought one or leased one.
Never.
Never did.
You would.
I drove one home for a couple of nights.
Mm-hmm.
But.
Were you unhappy with the liberties they'd taken with the original concept?
Yeah, I was. See, when I'd come up with an idea and work it out to where it looked like people wanted it, and there's many unsuccessful ones, no use even talking about them, I would figure there's different ways of doing it, and let the people who have the problem work it out their way. I just simply didn't want to be identified with it when it was out on the road.
Why?
I think I already said that I didn't like it, and I didn't want people saying, oh, you did that?
But the concept basically was still the same. They had just ignored your single engine concept.
Yeah, right.
Was that the only reason that you felt
definitely. I just didn't like it. And I didn't want to be identified.
You didn't
with
like
it.
The eight engine concept.
Yeah, I didn't like the complication. To me, that wasn't a good way of doing it.
Okay.
Excuse me again. This project of the retractable hardtop, to me, was not a success. It became too complicated, and the method of making it work that was put on the road prevented people from putting a decent amount of luggage into the car.
That meant the power plant was taking up most of the room in the...
The mechanism in general was taking up too much room. And as I said before, I rather disowned it because I didn't want to answer questions about it, about something I didn't do.
So it was introduced in what year?
Well, the Ford was introduced in 1957, I believe. It ran fairly successfully through 58. And then I think they had a couple of more production years, but...
1959, I think, was the last one.
Yeah.
2 years only.
Yeah, on a reduced scale.
It was not a critical success.
No, it wasn't. But some of the ideas that were generated by it, for example, different ideas came up on how to pull a top down. And they may not have been used on that particular model, or they may have been similar to it. But some of these ideas were used later on your cloth convertible tops. These things always generate ideas. For example, the deck lid with the pins at both ends, that idea was used for the tailgate, on the lower tailgate on the large Ford station wagons for quite a few years afterwards, where you could open that tailgate either on a vertical hinge axis or on a horizontal hinge axis. Remember that?
Yes.
Well, there's your retractable hinge pins that
showed
up.
The other concept you mentioned, of course, is that from time immemorial, cloth top convertibles had simply folded symmetrically into a pile,
mm-hmm.
and had been covered by a boot when the top was down.
Right.
Now you have the concept from the retractable hardtop, you have the cloth top of the convertible disappearing into the rear deck lid, as you had initially.
Right.
As on the Thunderbird of a later generation. Yeah.
Right. At any rate, when I got off this project, Earl McPherson decided he would like to have a studio of his own, which would be Engineering's Advanced Vehicles Group. And at this time, George Walker was a consultant, but there was much talk of him coming in as the new vice president of Styling. In other words, Styling would get out from under Engineering and be an equal entity. This happened, but McPherson started his studio in a different building with me as head of it. There was some competition at this time as to whether, I don't know if I should use the word competition, there was some argument between McPherson and George Walker as to whether I would stay working for Styling or whether I would go with Engineering.
What year was this?
That would have been, let's see if I can find it. That would have been mid-1955. McPherson and Walker didn't like each other from things they said. I ended up working for McPherson. My heart was with Styling, but I liked very much the idea of being able to do what I wanted to and build some cars the way I'd like to see them done. This was real great. We built several one-only cars, but McPherson retired, and we had our funding pulled out from under us. And
you did some prototypes in this
company? Yeah, we did some prototypes. We did one prototype, for example, had four headlights. Four headlights were coming in then, mm-hmm. And McPherson had the idea that the headlights should be evenly spaced across the hood of the car.
Mm-hmm.
We did a model that had a sloping hood, and it had four headlights protruding out from the hood in a sort of a streamlined manner. I didn't care for it. McPherson wanted it. And it is, of course, not the way the industry went.
You built full-size drivable prototypes?
Yeah, we did another that... Now, they weren't all completed because the funds disappeared.
Yeah.
I don't remember the names right now. We had the company spent quite a bit of money building the chassis for that one. It had other innovations in it. It had an air conditioner, which was new then. The air conditioner, half of it was in the deck behind the back seat. And we passed the air up through the C-pillars and along a pad that came from the C-pillars across the back and up the middle. And the air came out of holes. Cool air coming out the top would sink down to the floor someplace and be sucked to the back of the car again. And we provided bigger openings near the front because it was further from the source in order to get an even pressure. The car had different doors. I can't remember how they worked right now because we came up with many different door schemes. We also did a very short car, a shopper, which held four people abreast. It was like a shortened station wagon, and it was the type of thing that we felt a woman could take her children shopping with and so forth. And we had such ideas on it as when you lowered the tailgate, it could be in the form of a shopping basket, and you could wheel it away and then wheel it back into the car.
Detached.
Yeah. It had a roof that went up to provide space to get in and out.
Mm-hmm.
Had a lot of innovations, and a lot of the other things had that too. But as I say, the funding dropped out. I found out at that time that George Walker was on the committee that had to do with funding, and he was helping it drop out.
Uh-huh.
I imagine he'd rather have the money to spend on his projects. But eventually I had to find jobs for all the people working for me. I had quite a few designers and quite a few modelers there. I mean, I found jobs for them with Chrysler or other places, and closed the place down and go back to styling, which by that time was called design.
This was the engineering staff, advanced vehicles department.
That's right. That is, that's the difference. Okay. It says, yeah.
McPherson was retiring, and
he retired.
Money ran out.
Yeah, the money ran out. He tried a few of my other projects and ideas, and seemed happy to have me working with him.
But they never got beyond the prototypical stage.
Oh, a lot of them didn't. At that time, Earl was working on his McPherson strut.
Yes.
And he used to tell me about that. He had started that when he was at General Motors. And Ford had given him permission to continue working on it with no conflict. So it was his own. And just privately, I did some sketching for him. He had to have some working models made, but we didn't do those. We weren't equipped to make mechanical working things like that. But he was appreciated of it, but his successors were not.
Right. So you moved back to the design studio then?
I moved back to the design studios and suffered a bit of demotion.
You went back to from executive stylist to head stylist?
Yeah, I became head stylist, a basic Ford car. Mm-hmm. And the next few years are pretty much the same thing. By this time, Ford they had a policy of moving people like myself around about every 3 years, try you out at different things, and give you better experience for a future elevation and
right.
position.
Working largely in basic Ford designs. What was your?
These were production studios.
Yes,
I had the basic Ford car, and then I had Ford pre-production styling. This meant I was down in a basement for a year or so, a basement studio where nobody would see me or see what I was doing. While down there, we came up with the idea of using Dynoc on models. I hope I'm not going to run you out of
it. How do you spell that?
That's spelled D-Y-N-O-C.
What was that?
Dynoc is a trade name for a plastic film that has wood grain printed on it, and it is cemented in various ways to the sides of station wagons to imitate wood graining.
In other words, a very good decal.
Yeah, it's a decal. For several years, Ronnie Martin, George Martin's son, Ronnie at this time was my head modeler in the studio. Later he went over and became the head modeler for American Motors. But Ronnie and I would joke to the paint shop about the fact that we were going to come up with an idea someday that would eliminate our dependence upon them with our clay models. In those days, you took a full-size clay model. When you finished it and had to show it, Ford Division had a show every Friday, and Lincoln Mercury every Wednesday. We would have the model taken by riggers down to the paint shop, and they would paint the clay and make it as shiny looking as possible. Then when the model was moved, when we got the model down to the paint shops, it would have cracks in it. We'd have to go down and repair the cracks.
Mm.
They would paint it. It looked pretty good, but by the time it was moved back up to the showroom, it would be cracked all over again. And we wasted a lot of time. We would have liked to have had the time the paint shop had it to finish up our modeling, you know, do a better job. And so we kept joking with these fellows about putting them out of a job and getting rid of them and so forth. Typical banter. And we got talking about, well, heck, couldn't we put some kind of a film over the car and color it? And we talked about different things. This went on for a period of time. And finally, Ronnie came along and he said, hey, over in the factories, they use this Dynoc material. And I said, gee, that's right. Can we use it? And he said, well, let's try spraying a plasticizer on it. We got a sheet of it from the factory, and it was something they threw away. It was stale. We sprayed a plasticizer on it, and then we we blessed the clay model. This is just one fender of a full-size clay model. We sprinkled water on it. We blew water on the clay out of our lips, and we smoothed this stuff down, and we found out it stuck pretty well. So we had some painted a color. I think it was blue.
Translucent to film and plastic.
Not translucent, just thin film.
It didn't have to be translucent.
No, it didn't.
Okay.
And we found we could apply this to a compound surface. And by squeegeeing it down and so forth, we could get this thing looking pretty good.
What was the adhesive you used?
Water.
Water?
Yeah, we found we could...
Make it adhere to clay?
It was just simply, it formed a vacuum under it.
Okay.
You know the way you make something stick?
Mm-hmm.
We used a mixture of alcohol and water at first, but then we found water went fine. Well, I showed the idea to Damon Woods, under whom I was working at that time. And incidentally, I got Damon his job at first.
Did you?
Yeah.
What studio was that?
Well, that was when I was downstairs in the Ford pre-production styling.
Good.
It seemed to work, but all we had was this one fender covered with it. I showed it to Damon, and he didn't think much of it. He, you know, shrugged his shoulders and walked away. Another thing just stayed over in a corner of the room. It was a model we weren't using anyway.
But the models you were using were still cracking.
That's right.
Why would Damon say...
All of a sudden, about 6 months later, he called me on the phone and said, Gil, I've got three models up here I want you to cover with that Dynoc.
6 months of having models crack every time you move them?
Yeah.
Took that long?
And,
for him to...
It might have been 3 months. I don't remember. It was a long time.
Yeah.
I figured, well, okay, I've been rejected. Mm. Put it to one side, go on something else. And I said something like, Damon, I don't even know where to get a hold of this stuff, and we got to prepare it and so forth. Well, he was very disappointed. We didn't get it on several models for the showroom tomorrow, but I think we got them covered a couple of days later. That pretty much changed the way the styling operation proceeded when you got into the full size stage, because I think it's pretty much standard procedure with all the companies now.
Mm-hmm.
Naturally, the idea spread through people changing jobs.
Now, you would have this clear film, or at least unadorned film.
No, it was film that actually had wood grain printed on one side. We used it with that side down, and we painted the blank side, and then stuck it on the clay.
Why did it have wood grain on it?
Because they used it in the production, in the factories, to simulate wood grain on the sides of station wagons.
Oh, okay.
That's where it came from.
Okay. Oh,
yeah.
I'm sorry.
That's the only place we could find
They've been using that for about 3 or 4 years, haven't they?
Yeah, they had been using it in production, but nobody ever thought of putting this in a clay model, which
and
saved
just
the...
turn it over.
Yeah, we just turn it over.
I see.
Well, of course, once the idea caught on, design started ordering its own rolls of this stuff.
Okay.
And it finally got to where the paint shop, I think we increased their employment, because we made big racks, would hang this stuff over, and they would paint it before we used it.
Paint out the wood grain?
No, we were ordering our own film that did not have any wood grain on it.
What would they paint it? To your specifications?
They would paint it blue, green, whatever color we wanted.
And that was the color you wanted on the pre-production model.
See, in the production styling studios, you could walk into a styling studio and you might see full-size models, regardless of what they're made of, and they would be different colors. The green ones would be the 1953. The blue ones would be the 1954. We would often be working on 3 or 4 different years styling at the same time.
Yes,
and
right,
we would distinguish them one from the other by having them color-coded.
Okay.
So this is the way it went. Or sometimes we'd do a special color for get somebody's eye. But that, when, before Damon wanted that, suddenly demanded that thing, I had taken one of the modelers in the studio, an older man, and wasn't working too fast, and I don't remember his name, said, I want you to work on this thing. We got him some more film, and just keep working on it once in a while. Ask me or tell me, see if there's different ways of doing it. And so he did that. And some years later, it suddenly occurred to me, somebody could get an award for coming up with that idea. Now, I couldn't, because that's my job. Mm. The designers don't get that type of
incentive award.
So I looked this man up. He was in a different studio, or I was by that time, and proposed that he apply for it. The people in my studio were all behind this idea, because what we were going to do was let this man get the award, which would be a big one, and use the money for a big blowout, big party.
What was the idea?
The using the Dynoc to eliminate all these troubles with the paint shop and all the time. This is a work process that was, it really saved money and time.
Had it been in use for some time?
It had been in use to make false wood panels on the sides of production cars. It had not been used in this styling process. Okay. Completely different thing, really, different use. It's like using a paddle for a fly swatter. It's different, same thing, but different. When the fellow got the money, and it was over $1,000, he put it in his pocket, wouldn't give it to us for the party. End of that subject. And during this time, I'm trying to hustle along here. I think when I had the, was it the Thunderbird or no, the basic Ford car, I came up with the idea for the rather giant tail lamps that Ford had back in those days. The inspiration was the rear orifice of a fighter plane's jet engine, mm-hmm. You know, big round pipe that was red hot mm-hmm. and blasting. We were working a lot of nights then, and I went out to I think it was Woolworths, and I bought one of those cake tins that has a center that comes up.
Mm-hmm.
And a nice shiny surface, mm-hmm. and without asking anybody, because it was, at nighttime, why had a modeler stick that, or two of them, in the back of a car. Mm-hmm. I put a weak electric light bulb in there, and I got one of those interrupters that makes a light flash, led a cord through the clay and out the bottom, and plugged it into an extension cord, and seems to me we also took a paper lily cup and painted that, sprayed it with silver, mm-hmm. put it together, and we had a preliminary showing the next morning, early in the morning, and this thing absolutely grabbed people. Ford followed that line of doing things for quite a while.
You're talking about an angel food cake tin.
Yeah.
You stuck it into the clay model at the rear.
Yeah. The actual tail light is a small thing,
mm-hmm.
which we simulated, and the part out around it simply picked up all that red light and reflected it.
Was the housing, yeah.
Yeah. It,
so you then took an inverted lily cup.
Yeah.
And stuck that in the middle.
Yeah. That became our, it was a red plastic drinking glass.
Oh.
And the bulb was inside of that. But that became, Ford sort of followed that for several years with variations of the basic idea.
Initially on the Thunderbird, is that right?
I think it was. Another one I did, and I think this was on either the Thunderbird, it was on a Mercury car. I put three lights, three tail lights on a clay model on each side, and had them work sequentially so that if you're going to make a left turn, you'd get blink, blink, blink. And again, surprise people with this in the morning.
From inside to out.
Yeah, it was strictly bending some plastic over some wood pieces shoved into the end of a clay model, and I had learned this at when I was with Bob Bingman. We designed some radios, and we found that instead of presenting our client with a painted clay model of a radio, that if we stuck a real radio inside it and made the knob so they could turn them on and play it, that they got the idea. It helped sell, and this same thing really worked.
What year was the sequential turn signal adopted? You know?
I don't remember. I was only reminded of it because yesterday, or the day before, someplace I got behind an old one somebody had, And I never caught up with a car. It was a woman driving it, and she turned off, and I was going someplace in a hurry. I was telling my wife, hey, you know, I remember coming up with that idea and putting on a clay model and amazing people with it.
Mm-hmm.
But
you were still in the advanced pre-production studio.
I think I was upstairs. I now had production studios. Mercury or else Thunderbird and Falcon mm-hmm. styling.
Okay,
I don't remember. See, I was in studios that kind of used the same things here for a few years.
Okay.
I actually don't recall. Eventually, I got advanced styling back again, but in a bigger sense. I think they call it corporate project studio, and we started doing. We were doing tractors full size. We were ending the day when we used to send quarter size and 3/8 size models overseas. See, advanced styling also did the overseas styling.